That's Under Touch with Equal Rights, the title track of his 1977 album. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today we return to two cases that we had explored in depth with our extraordinary luck of having Attorney at War Alton Maddox as our guide. He officially, I have adopted him, if he allows me to say that, as our legal scholar in residence and as our analyst, especially in these kinds of cases where he has had, over the course of almost 40 years in litigation in the people's behalf, always pro bono, litigating police brutality cases and winning and scoring many precedents in the law along the way. So we return to the series that we did with Alton Maddox today, updating these two cases, the death last April of Freddie Gray, 25 years old, a week after suffering severe spinal injuries while being transported to a Baltimore police station house after a contentious, and some contend, illegal arrest, and the killing of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald on October the 20th last year by Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke. A Baltimore judge declared a mistrial yesterday in the case against Officer William Porter, one of six officers charged in Gray's death, and the first of the six to be tried, after a jury said it was hopelessly deadlocked in deciding four charges against him. And in Chicago, yesterday as well, Officer Van Dyke formally was charged with six counts of murder in the shooting death of Laquan McDonald. You will recall this 17-year-old was shot 16 times by Officer Van Dyke. Alton, first of all, I thank you for being with us again today, and I want to start with I want to just verify that when you talked about this case of Freddie Gray last week, you made a prediction about it, and your prediction was that the officer was going to walk. And you said it was for a particular reason. I say again, we have the benefit of somebody who knows these things. You were able to predict this, as you have been able to predict on the nail. I mean, you on the head of the nail every time, the outcome of many cases, but you have been able to explain it to us what the legal cause was. So could I ask you to do that piece of work right up front? We have seen now that it has turned out the way you said it was going to turn out. And could you return us to the rationale, the legal strategy that seems to have gone wrong here?
Well, I will certainly do that, Eutrice, and I appreciate the invitation to come on your broadcast. And I would just simply like to say that I would like for the people who are listening to this program to realize that they are getting an extraordinary treat in this program, one that is not duplicated on CNN or MSNBC. And it is my goal to strengthen this program because it is so valuable to our community. And so I want everybody to really turn out tomorrow at the Cotton Club to do that, because that's what we are doing. We had to predict a date when we should hold this workshop, and it should be after the Freddie Gray trial. Now, as it relates to Freddie Gray, what I said was is that there are some things that are not taught in law school, And there are some courses that are optional in law school. But for anyone who wants to be in the business of putting police officers behind bars, they have to take particular subjects. And one of those subjects is international law. And while there are different branches of the law, starting with international law and going into SCIVIL, RIGHTS, because sometimes we get that confused, SILVERRITES, this case, as it relates to police officers, always involves international law. And one of the principles of international law, as was exemplified in the Nuremberg trials, is the type of prosecution that has to occur when you deal with people who are acting under color of law. And in this particular case, Freddie Gray's trial, you had that. But the problem in Freddie Gray's trial was, and this is why I said right from the beginning that nothing would happen, because I know that. You have to have a frame of reference, you know, and that's what I try to do to our people and to our community, to give them with a frame of reference. When you go to the law, when you go to a library, the first thing you do is ask for a reference librarian. You have to have a frame of reference. And so in this regard, what I said was, is that Brian Rice should have been the lead defendant. Lieutenant Brian Rice was the supervising officer in Baltimore at the time that Freddie Gray's was seized unlawfully by the Baltimore Police Department, and that the ultimate responsibility was Hill's. However, when the state's attorney decided to draft the indictment and go before a grand jury before drafting the indictment and then sought to prosecute, Brian Rice was not there as number one or number two as a defendant. And so right then and there, it was clear to me that that prosecution had to fail because it is a flawed prosecution under international law. It is a flawed prosecution under the Nuremberg case. And that's the reason why I said from the beginning several months ago is that we need to make sure that this is a class action and that that we are involved in it as a people, because this is not an act against Freddie Gray. This is an act against all descendants of enslaved Africans. And when Dr. King said that injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere, what he was referring to is the fact that these are class actions. You know, we hear what people say, we quote what people say, but we don't know what they mean when they say it. Dr. King was a philosopher, and so when he said that, he would basically tell black people, you got to engage in class actions in order to pursue justice. And so it was necessary to do that, and it was not done, and matter was declared a mistrial, and that's the reason why I said that the 19th of December was very necessary for us to assemble and then say, where do we go from here? And that's basically what the situation was, and it was just very predictable to me because, you know, law is not something that is up in the air. People may think that, but it's very predictable. And you can do that. It's just that lawyers are not taught to do it, and law schools are in cahoots with the prison industrial complex. And so we are getting the result that, as far as the legal system is concerned, we deserve.
Well, I appreciate your argument about the class action, but here's the question that arises out of that. would a prosecutor, and you just mentioned about how prosecutors are trained and how they approach the prosecution of criminal cases, how does a class action, which most people see to be a civil action, how does this a class action, how is it accommodated within the framework of what prosecutors typically do? How do they proceed with the prosecution of a class action when most people would be expecting that the prosecutor would be basically framing the case within the criminal code?
Well, the reason why I say that is because it starts with the caption of the case. And it's right there in front of you when you are prosecuted. The caption of the case reads, either the people or the state or the United States versus somebody. That's what the caption case says every time. It's right there in black and white. It's in bold print. And what you have to understand, this is a class action. That's what they're saying by giving you notice of that. And that you will be defeated if you come in there as a person instead of a class. That's the reason why so many black people go to jail, because they misread the indictment. You know, they think the indictment is just against one person. It's not against one person. It is against everybody, but nobody gonna tell you that. I mean, if you can't figure that out. And so that's how they get us, because it is a class action from both sides, from the prosecution point of view, and it should be a class action from the defense point of view. And that's what Dr. King was saying when he said the statement about injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. That's what he was saying, but we didn't understand that. But that's what he was saying. He was telling us as well as he could. Sometimes our leaders have to be muted in what they say. And, you know, and sometimes we consider some people Uncle Toms because they don't give it to us in black and white. But sometimes we just can't ask for them to give it to us in black and white. We got to have our thinking caps on and be able to figure some of this stuff out. And when you put two and two together, it is a class action on both sides of the equation.
Now, this prevailing view that you have about the class action nature of this case and cases like it, who proceeds along those lines, and how does a prosecutor, again, constrained or seemingly constrained by what they understand the law to be and following the so-called letter of the law, criminal codes that apply and so forth, the process that has been the process for years and years, within those frameworks, who does this? Who comes up with a class action suit? Is this something independently pursued?
Well, I think we have to start with things that are accepted in the law, unfortunately. The first thing that is acceptable in the law is that prosecutorial discretion is unreviewable. That's unreviewable. The second thing in the law is that political motivation is also unreviewable. And so when you put those two elements together, you're going to have an unjust result. And that is because most of us do not know the history of the law. And so when we don't know the history of anything, we're in trouble. And, you know, Marcus Garvey told us that, is that a people without a history is like a race or a tree without a root. You know, I mean, you can't survive if you're going to think that you can get through this without history. And so the history of the grand jury, for example, is that of 24 white knights. That's how the grand jury started. When the grand jury process started in England, it started with the convening of 24 white knights who were assembled to protect the king and to weed out all dissenters. And so this is the whole process. This is probably, this is the reason why you have a secret grand jury today, because you're not supposed to know who those grand jurors are And therefore, you know, you don't know what their motivation might have been in being white knights. And so, you know, that's something, not even something that's discussed in our people. We was over there in Staten Island a few weeks ago with Public Advocate the teacher James, who didn't have the foggiest notion of what she was doing because she didn't have any knowledge of history. And so people don't know that when you deal with grand juries, you're dealing with white knights. And the chief white knight today in the United States is Donald Trump, you know. And so that's what he does. And what a white knight does is to make sure that there's no takeover by anybody else, which is why he is saying that all Muslims should not be in the United States. He's serious about that. He's not joking. And he may very well become the next president of the United States because everybody's taking him to be a joke. And this man is dead serious. He went to a military academy, and he went to Wharton School of Finance, and I tried to outline this in an article that I wrote for the website, www.realestateautomatics.com. This is what we're dealing with out here. And a lot of what we are dealing with is secret. And so, therefore, we don't see those processes that are secret. And the courts will not allow you to review those processes because they are secret and beyond review.
Well, Judge Barry Williams is discussing with the prosecutors today and the defense attorney for William Porter whether and how he might be retried or what happens at this case. We don't know what the substance of these discussions has been. We don't know where the case is going right at the moment. But let's just theorize for a minute that the state will proceed with a retrial, in which case, what do you expect to crop up as a major legal obstacle the second time around?
Well, you know, that's an excellent question. And again, it requires a lot of examination. That's the reason why I tell people I can only be so good at being a legal analyst if I have the tools. If people choose to withhold the tools from me, you know, you can't expect a great result. But you're raising a very good question. And that question would require having some tools. Now, habitually, I would say that the trial of William Porter should actually be the next on the slate. That's what I would say habitually. And I would say that because I don't have Maryland court rules or anything of that effect. But I can say what would normally be the process would be that Porter would be retried before the other cases go on top. Now, if, for example, you know, people in Baltimore are saying, well, right now we just need a new jury, you know, and so whatever happens, as long as it's not the same jury, we'll be all right. Well, that's wrong because, again, now you're dealing with the same accusatory instrument. That's what the defective is not in a jury. The jury doesn't have anything to do with this process. The different accusatory instrument could have a different effect in this process. But if you're going to use the same accusatory instrument, it doesn't matter whether you got a different different jury or not, or even a different judge. The process and the result is going to be the same. And that's what we have to do, is to examine this flawed accusatory instrument. Now, upon examining that, then you come up with another issue that now exists. It did not exist the first time around, but it may very well exist this time around, and that is the question of double jeopardy. Because now you have also given Porter some different weapons that he would not have had on the initial prosecution. And so, and double jeopardy is a very tricky question. I mean, you know, to go through double jeopardy, you would actually have to have a crystal ball. You certainly have to have some legal tools. to deal with that, because that's the nature of what the legal system is about. But, you know, as I said before, to some people, they may say, you know, well, we should just dismantle this grand jury, dismantle the indictment, and then restart again. Now, that seems to be very plausible, but as I said before, now, because he's already had one trial, you know, you have given him some other defenses that he may have outside of a courtroom to walk. And so, you know, it gets very difficult at this point. That's why I tell black people, you know, you cannot just simply get on a bus and ride down the highway and say you're going to free Mamiya and think that that's going to end this process. It does not end this process. It's too much more difficult than that. And the question is, why do our people want to remain ignorant and try to fight this process in the meantime?
Does it not also open a window here of opportunity for Porter if he should be, if the prosecutor should be threatening to try him again, where, in fact, his lawyers can now have even greater bargaining power to say, if he is granted immunity for any testimony he's about to give in the second go-round, he will cooperate?
Well, I think that that is an argument that could be made. But what we have to realize in this country is that Porter is an oath taker. And, you know, it's just like anybody who's a member of the Democratic Party is an oath taker. And so, you know, and we are not ready to be members of a political party because we don't have a political education. And so when you're dealing with oath takers, there are other risks that you're dealing with. I mean, New York brought 70 counts against Al Sharpton. Now, on the face of it, it just seemed like they were criminal elements. It just seemed like he was engaging in all kinds of actions. But the motivation had nothing to do with crime. The motivation had something to do with the fact that Al Sharpton was being a switch hitter, and people were tired of that, and that's the reason why they tried to convict him, because he was a switch hitter. Once you enroll in one party, you're not supposed to be able to give aid and comfort to another party. That's what Sharpton did. He violated election law, which is not something that's subject to motivation. I mean, we can go into court and say, well, this is what motivated the judge, but it is very important, or the grand jury, but it's very important for black people who enroll in the Democratic Party to know is that if you are in that party under states' rights, because voting is a states' rights issue, you have to be wedded to, as a Democrat, President Thomas Jefferson and President Andrew Jackson. That's the reason why I say it's plantation politics. You know, but our people don't understand that. That's the reason why we're endorsing our oppression, and we're waiting for Hillary to get in office now, and she named her daughter Chelsea, and we don't know what that means. So, you know, it's just a lot of ignorance that we have to go through in that process. But this is what the situation is as it relates to Freddie Gray.
The jury had said it was hopelessly deadlocked. Those are the words that it used. Hopelessly deadlocked, even though it was their first signal to the court that they were in trouble in terms of arriving at a unanimous decision. Isn't that unusual? And what does that suggest to you?
Well, you know, again, that's a great question, and it needs to go under further examination, because the reality of it is that that was a very short period of time for a court to declare a mistrial, especially in a situation where the judge have no facts before him to say that it is a mistrial. I mean, this is, you know, now you're dealing with legal conclusions, and the conclusion would be normally that you better go back and we better give you an Allen charge and other things on the table before you can declare this a mistrial. And an Allen charge is like a dynamite charge to a jury. And no Allen charge was ever given. And so now you have a question as to whether this was pre-planned or not. And then you have the question as to whether the juror of commissioners, because in any trial, you know, that I tried, I would put the juror of commissioners on first, because the jury is very important in terms of the outcome of a case. And I would want to make sure that this jury system was not stacked. And so, you know, when you don't put the juror of commissioners on and examine the juror of commissioners before you can sanitize the jury itself, I mean, you're playing with a wild deck. And so the question is very excellent. And as I said before, habitually, people do not declare hopelessly deadlocked juries until at least there's an Allen charge, and at least until there have been a considerable amount of time of jury deliberation.
What does this say about the capacity of the prosecutor's office to actually develop a legal strategy before you, you know, set about the business of the actual trial? It seemed to me that this trial had unusual speed to it, and even now, I mean, unusual speed in declaring hopelessly deadlocked, and unusual speed the judges meeting with the prosecutors and defense attorneys today to decide, well, let's get this thing back on track ASAP. It seems that there's a great deal of you know, a rush to get this trial back on track, which I suppose in one way indicates that they're interested in getting justice. But I'm concerned about whether the getting from the prosecutor's office an indication of a certain level of expertise that is needed. We know Porter really should not have been the first defendant, and that suggests maybe inexperience, or maybe it suggests something else, I don't know. But why is it that do you get a sense that this is a kind of rush is going on here?
Well, I certainly get that. And you, Trish, I think, first of all, the next thing on the plate is for people not to forget that I am the only attorney in the United States who ever got more than one special prosecutor. Because when my nose told me that I should avoid that, that's what I did. Because I know that you can't have a balanced prosecution with a just result when you have an unbalanced prosecutorial staff. And so that's the reason why I had to put my foot down, and a lot of times people don't understand it. You know, black people see things and don't see that the risk that you're taking to defend them. And we enjoy somebody who won't take any risk, and we give them all of the glory, even though they took no risk. And when somebody take a risk, well, you're fine until you get snagged. And then when you get snagged, we're going to run from you, even though it may have been a bogus disciplinary proceeding that was initiated against you. And so, yes, it's very important for you to have a prosecutor that's correct. In our cases, it was very important for you to have independent counsel. And it's also very important for you to have a juror of commissioners who is under examination. All this part of the process. So when you are being a shortchanged, you know, this is what the result that comes about. It would not come about with anybody who demanded all of their rights. But when you don't know what your rights are, and you're not willing to listen to somebody who knows who your rights are, this is the result that we are getting.
Apart from Lieutenant Brian Rice, the supervisor, who you said should have been further up on the chain here in terms of prosecution, we have this question, and it continues to puzzle me as to why Officer Cesar Goodson, the person who Officer Porter said he notified that perhaps Gray was in serious trouble and needed medical assistance, but Goodson did not render medical assistance. And apart from the other charges which are shared by the police officers, Goodson in particular is charged with second-degree depraved heart murder. Now, why wasn't he, in your view, the first to go to trial? Or should I put it this way, why was he not prosecuted before Porter was prosecuted?
Well, if you really want to look at this indictment and look at the food chain, Brian Rice should be at the top. Then you had the two cops who were white should be right next to Brian Rice. And then you have Goodson and the rest of these people because these two white cops who helped Brian Rice are part of the problem. And that's the way that the indictment would have to be drafted to not only include Rice, but to include his two compatriots. The question is, why aren't these two white officers also at the top of the food chain? Now, the way they have it now, I think Goodson will be going next. But I don't see any legal rationale for prosecuting Goodson at this point of time, even though Porter may have implicated him in some manner or another. I think you have to go by the recipe of a Nuremberg prosecution and deal with the two cops who happen to also be white as your targets in this prosecution.
What, in the end, does this mistrial mean for the state, you think?
Well, I think what it means for the state is obviously there has to be good relations between a collective bargaining unit and the city. And when the collective bargaining unit, in this case the Fraternal Order of Police, is able to shelter all of its members, I think as far as the city is concerned, they're better off than when there was some people in the collective bargaining unit who may have a real beef. And so this is the part of the process also that I think has to be examined. I do not believe that these fraternal orders of police or these PBAs, as we have here in New York City, should have the right to engage in collective bargaining and operate as a collective bargaining unit and therefore put pressure on the city and on the prosecutorial office in terms of what direction they have to take with individual members of the collective bargaining unit.
Should the prosecutor in this case be switched out? Should the prosecutor be compelled to recuse herself from this case?
I think so. You know, I think that definitely, you know, as I said before, you can't try cases in which the prosecutorial office has a relationship with their police officers, their allies. And so the first step that you would take in this process would be to demand as a class that she step down, not as an individual, because you're not going to find any lawyers individually who would take that position, except myself. I mean, I haven't seen nobody else would do that. So, you know, and that's not the norm. You know, what I did in New York would put my own career on the line for our people, even when they didn't know what in the war they were doing themselves. Because most of the time, what I did was despite black people, not because of them. You know, I mean, just be real about it, because I had as many critics as you want to understand. So, you know, really, you have to have a class in order to do this, because you're not going to be able to protect individual lawyers, and no individual lawyers are going to take the position of an Alton Maddox. I mean, that's just, it's simple that. And we have to begin to accept this, certain things as truth. You know, black people cannot handle the truth. But the reality of it is, this is something that you just have to handle. There are only certain people out here who are going to take their position. And in your lifetime, you've only seen one.
We'll take this break and come back and talk about Officer Jason Van Dyke, who just yesterday was charged with 6 counts of murder in the killing of Laquan McDonald in Chicago.
is due to Caesar. You better give it on to Caesar. Hey, hey, hey. And what belongs to I, you better give it up to I. Cause I don't want no peace, and it equal rights and justice. I need equal rights and justice. I've got to get it.
Equal rights
and justice. I'm fighting for it.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead. My guest is our legal instructor, Alton H. Maddox, Jr., who has, in the course of a 40-year career, racked up several precedents, legal precedents, in fighting cases involving, among other things, lethal use of force by police and police brutality. Just yesterday in Chicago, Officer Jason Van Dyke formally was indicted on 6 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of official misconduct for shooting to death 17-year-old Laquan McDonald in October last year. The case, we discussed this as part of the series about how and why and when rogue cops seem to be prosecuted. You should know, of course, that Officer Van Dyke was freed on $1.5 million bail on November the 30th. He had by then spent about 6 nights in jail, but was able to make bail, and now faces these 6 murder counts. Alton, this is an interesting question because the indictment came after incredible activity on the part of people all around the country, but principally in Chicago, a face down with the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, over this, an apology, quote unquote, by the mayor himself, who indicted by words the officer and indicted his actions and say in no way. And said in no way does Van Dyke represent the police department and members of the police department in Chicago. But in any event, it comes after a storm of protest. And number one, is that the first defense for Laquan McDonald, that he's a victim of political retribution rather than justice?
Okay, let me sorry, rephrase that question, Yatree. Are you asking about Jason Van Dyke, about the estate of Laquan McDonald? So, you know, I just want to get that straight before I get the answer.
No, whether Jason Van Dyke could immediately make a defense by saying he was indicted only because it was politically expedient and not because he merited indictment.
Okay. Let me just give an audience a brief frame of reference because I don't want people to think that I do this just by waving a magic wand. That's not the process at all. It takes real quick to do it. 3 things I would always do in any case in which I was representing a client. 1, I never ask the client what happened. 2, I never ask the client to take the witness stand. And 3, I never ask the client to plead guilty. Those 3 things never happen. I forbid all 3 of them. So how would I get around that? Well, I would get around it by doing this. I just got this indictment today. And so, therefore, you know, some things that I would have to answer would be beyond today. But what I would say for today is this. You see, every indictment is like, and you understand this very much from your role as a journalist. Every indictment is like a sentence. You have to diagram the sentence. You have to diagram the indictment, which is why I never ask any client to tell me what happened, because the grand jury has just told you what happened. So why do I need for you to speculate as to what may be important or not important? You can't answer that because the grand jury has already spoken. Here's the indictment here. The question I have to do is to diagram and dissect this indictment. And so when you do that, you know, you get some idea of what the grand jury is actually saying. Of course, one of the things that Jason Van Dyke will do is to claim that this is politically motivated. You know, as I started off this discussion today, I said that normally political motivation is unreviewable. But here you have a police officer who may want to raise the same claim and the same argument, and because he is a cop and has a different relationship with the judicial system, you know, they may embrace his claim, where if you or I raise the same claim, it would be thrown in the trash can immediately. So, yes, there's definitely an argument about political motivation in this case, and that's why you need a class action in order to counter that. You see, you can't expect individuals, or you can't expect the prosecutor's office to counter that, because the prosecutor herself, the state's attorney in Illinois, should now be facing an indictment herself. And that is what the people of Chicago should have done. And, you know, and I always tell people all the time, the three things that you have to do in life when you're dealing with the legal system, you have to knock on the right door, you have to talk to the right people, and you have to ask the right questions. And so far, apparently, nobody in Chicago is knocking on the right door, and certainly they're not asking the right questions. And so, you know, this is what we're talking about here. But, yeah, there's no question about it. It's definitely a political motivation that he will be arguing right from the outset.
Well, something else. Police officer Jason Van Dyke was not the only officer present when Laquan McDonald was shot and killed by him, shot and killed with 16 bullets. So why is he the person that State's Attorney Anita Alvarez is singling out for this indictment on six murder counts and not other officers?
Well, I want everybody to listen to me very carefully, because I tried to convene a workshop on November the 7th under Driving While Black with Sandra Bland, because I was subject at that moment to a prosecution myself, People versus Maddox, in Del Mar, New York. And so I tried to bring people together to plan how we were going to beat this. You know, unfortunately, everybody ran for the tall grass, and that's one of the problems we have to look at as a people. Are we really serious or not? Now, the way you would counter this would be to ask the state of Illinois attorney general, not the state's attorney, the attorney general of Illinois, not Loretta Lynch, Department of Justice, the state attorney general of Illinois, should be asked to render an opinion as to whether these other cops observed a crime and should they be prosecuted. That's the first thing you do. And a state, an attorney general opinion is a tool that is used in every state. It is not known, however, by black people. And so that's why, you know, you have to listen to somebody who knows the system before you get ready to fight the system, and not jump on a bus and ride to Stratton talking about you're going to free somebody when you don't have the foggiest notion of what you're doing.
This also is a case in which the city of Chicago came to terms with the family of Laquan McDonald in terms of a settlement. How will that factor into the trial when he does come to trial?
Well, it will factor in, because you see, under white supremacy, white people realize that is unethical. You know, we don't know anything about ethics, but they know everything about Essex, and we don't want to learn anything about Essex, and they embrace Essex to the heist. Now, that doesn't mean that you're talking about people who are religious when you talk about Essex, even if they're moral, but they're ethical, and they understand what Essex means. They also understand that McDonald's family is unethical, and so if any of them are on the jury, it's going to have a tremendous effect on the outcome, because you see, again, we need to understand some history. The SILVERITES movement was officially sanctioned in 1972, and we need to understand that history. And the Supreme Court came up with that in order to undermine any civil rights actions by black people. And we don't understand what that means. That's the reason why, you know, I scheduled the 19th of December as a day of workshop. I'm not making any money off of this workshop. It will cost me $40 a person to give a buffet to. And that's what they will receive Saturday. It would also cost me more than $60 for floor space. You can't rent a club or any place out for 6 hours. Or 7 hours, and don't have to pay for the cost of floor space. So I'm already behind the eight ball. I'm trying to help people, you know, but I don't need people trying to undermine me while I'm trying to help you. And so this is what I'm saying. We are way over our heads, and we should not be over our heads. And when there's somebody who has a frame of reference and can use that frame of reference for the good of the community, we should be rallying behind that person. I'm not asking to lead anybody now. I'm too old to be leading people. You know, but I'm just simply saying you ought to have enough sense to know that when you need advice, you need the consultation and from somebody who knows what they're doing. You at least know that. And sometimes even when you go to the doctor, you have to ask for a second opinion, I mean, before you move on anything. So, you know, we don't know those steps. We're in trouble. But, yeah, hush money will have a tremendous effect on the outcome of this case.
Does Jason Van Dyke now, because initially he was charged with one count of first-degree murder, it has now been amped up to six counts of first-degree murder plus one count of official misconduct. Does, in fact, Jason Van Dyke have a series of excellent defenses, even though the situation is grave as it is, does he not have not only excellent defenses here as a person who was singled out and made to pay a price because of the political situation and people wanting to save their own hide, and they basically dumped everything in his lap, but when this happens, when he makes this argument, which I expect him to make, that he is a victim of a political retribution, does it not suggest also that maybe the state's attorney could figure out that even though for public relations purposes she looks very resolute and in pursuit of justice, she still is opening, keeping the back door open so that he can make a pretty decent exit?
Yeah, well, that's another excellent question. And the answer is yes. She has definitely opened up a back door. I mean, that's the nature of any prosecution of a cop, is to open up the back door. And this is no different. Now, which doors have been opened is another question. That's the reason why you need legal tools. To be able to look at this indictment, which I have right in front of me, and be able to look at those sections of the law and get an understanding of what they require, look at the indictment itself, and then realize where those doors are. So you're absolutely correct. That's what this is about. And I hope, starting next week, you know, that I would have been fully supported on the 19th. So that I can come back and not only help you in this case, and help the community in this case, help the community in Mumia Abu-Jamal case, help the community in Wayne Williams and Jameel Abdullah Alameen, as well as Tawana Brawley, because you got to have those tools to get very deeply involved And the correct thing that I did do was to schedule this for the 19th. So I accurately predicted not only what was going to happen in Freddie Gray's case, but I also predicted the date that we should look at all of this to figure out where do we go from here.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us again today and for being available to let us understand the complexities. I mean, these things are just not discussed in the public realm. So people are probably hearing this for the first time, making sense of what the reality is. And I talk about this all the time, the manufactured reality, people basically presenting unreality as reality, the media participating vigorously in promoting unreality and in obfuscating things and covering things up. And many times they themselves don't understand what it is they're looking at. So they pass that along as well. So I want to thank you so much. And of course, as things develop, we'll be leaning on you to help us understand these things in greater detail. Thank you very much, Alton, for being with us today.
Well, thank you as well, Eutrice. As I said before, my date is the 19th of December. Anybody who needs financial aid should call 718-834-9034, 718-834-9034 for that. And if the wires are loaded at the time, call back at some time in order for us to get back to you to make sure that you can benefit from financial aid.
We have a couple of minutes, so maybe you can tell us what is happening on the 19th.
Well, you know, one of the things I did, Eutrice, you know, you have to have a calendar, you know, and whatever you do, you have to have a calendar. And so, you know, I looked at what was going on. I looked at Mamiya. I looked at the case of Freddie Gray, you know, and I looked at the potential of Chicago coming down with an indictment. And so I realized, you know, you have to be able to act immediately. Once you get all of that on your plate, you got to be able to act immediately. And so I plan to act immediately on where do we go from here on the 19th, because this is a class action and it may not be in New York City at the moment, but it's in Baltimore, it's in Chicago, you know, it's in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and other places. So that's what we're going to be doing, is planning that date. Now, as for people who want to go to Scranton for Mamiya, well, that's fine. You know, ride down there, get on the bus. But when you come back, Mamiya's going to still be behind bars, because Mamiya's problem is the absence of counsel. He's not been able to get that. He wasn't able to get that in 1981. He wasn't able to get that in 1995. And he's not getting it now. And so, you know, you have to ask yourself, what counsel does he need? Now, the only person that's been able to do anything positive in Mamiya Abu-Jamal's case is myself. And that was in 1995 when we were able to develop a plan to stay the execution. It should not take a rocket scientist to figure that the only thing you need now is to get on a bus and leave Scranton and go down to Harrisburg and ask the officials in Harrisburg, isn't it rather strange that Alton Maddox had never been disciplined in Pennsylvania, even though he's admitted to Pennsylvania, and now we have the case of Mamiya Abu-Jamal, and why can't Alton Maddox represent Mamiya? Now, that's what people need to do as they're riding down to Scranton today. Tell the bus driver to head over to Harrisburg and get that answer.
Thanks again, Alton. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Eutrice. And, you know, anytime I'm always loving this case and loving your program in order to get the word out.
Thank you so much. That brings us to the end of our program today. I hope it filled in many, many blanks, and it gave you a better understanding of the structure of the system that is being confronted here and that we have to deal with. And, you know, when you read stories and you get the facts, you find out that there's a lot that is missing. And hopefully this puts us closer to the facts and closer to the understanding that we ought to have when these cases are being prosecuted. Thanks so much for joining me. Keep it right here on PRN.FM. Expanding Mind with Eric Davis is up next. And you can write me, let me know, drop me a note. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you at leadstories@gmail.com. This is your weekend coming up, and tomorrow is Free Your Mind Friday. I hope we'll have a vigorous open forum tomorrow. Until then, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Thanks. Bye-bye.